Whoa. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
That's what I like to hear. And shalom to you as well, and thank you to the choir for that beautiful music. My opening words this morning, our call to worship, comes from my friend and colleague, Kathleen McTeague, who served for many years in our congregation in New Haven and is now the director of our College of Social Justice with the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. In the struggles we choose for ourselves, in the ways we move forward in our lives and bring our world forward with us, it is right to remember the names of those who gave us strength and a choice of living. It is right to name the power of hard lives lived well. Gathered here, we share a history with those lives. We belong to the same motion that makes us a movement. We are strengthened by what has gone before. We are drawn by a vision of what might become. Those who have lived before us, who have struggled for justice, who have suffered injustice before us, have not melted into dust. They have not disappeared. They are with us still. Their lives are lived within us now. Their words remind us and call us back to our better selves. Their courage and love evokes our own. We the living, we gathered here, carry them with us. We take them with us, and with them we choose the deeper path of living, the path of justice and hope and mercy and grace. It is good to be together. And I'm going to call up Aiden and Yubshara to come on up. I got it. I'm working on it. And they're going to light the chalice for us.
Please join me saying the chalice lighting words in your order of service. Chalice flame to remind ourselves of the light of truth, the warmth of community, and the fire of commitment.
Let's stay standing and recite together the words of our affirmation, which are on the front cover of your hymnal or deep in your heart. Join our voices as we say, love is the spirit of this church,
and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another.
You may be seated.
There we go. Come on up, everybody. Oh, all right, I got to step back because there's more of you than there are of me. Man, who's ready for spring? Huh? Yeah. How about the big kids?
Yeah,
all right. There we go. That's good. All right, so I'm going to tell you a story. Somebody asked me, I think one of you asked me this week, what's my favorite story? So I decided I'm going to tell you my favorite story. That way it's not a secret anymore, okay? All right. This is a story by Sam Swoop. It's known, and the search committee knows this story. It's called The Arab Bullies of Liberty Street. Liberty Street was a nice, quiet street where every house was just the same. They were white with a white picket fence. And General and Mrs. Pinch, who lived on Liberty Street, liked it that way. Everything was tidy. There was not a lot of noise. Everybody cut their grass on the same day. See? I remember. And the daffodils came up, and they were always the same. And if the kids got too noisy on Liberty Street, General Pinch would say, "Quiet down there, or I'll call out the army." No. The kids were afraid of the army. They didn't know what that meant, but they didn't want the army to come. So they were like, "Nah, this is not a good thing." Then one day, somebody new moves onto Liberty Street, the Arabuli family. The Arabulis weren't like anybody else. For one thing, their skin was all kinds of different colors. And I'm not talking about the usual colors. I'm talking about pink and purple and orange and neon yellow and neon green. I'm looking at your shirts. Yeah, that works. It was all those colors, and they had stripes and stars, and it was a big family. There was mother and father, and there were like 8 kids and grandma and grandpa. And the first thing they did when they got to their house was they painted it all different colors, just like their skin. You can imagine what happened when General and Mrs. Pinch looked out their window. "Disgusting," she said. And he said, "I might have to call in the army." Anyway, it got better because they took all the furniture and they put it on the outside of the house. And then the animals, they brought these crazy animals like aardvarks and anteaters and armadillos, and that's only the A's. And they like let the animals sleep inside the house. And they slept outside the house, and they all slept on this gigantic bed, which is half as big as this room, and they snored. Oh, General Pinch was most unhappy about this. And Mrs. Pinch thought that was disgusting. And the Arabuli kids loved to have fun. They played with all the other kids on the street, and they liked to play in the street. And one day they were playing the game of wiffle ball, which is a beach ball about this big, and a big bat, plastic bat, and they would whack it as hard as they could. And one time, one of the Arabuli kids hit that ball so hard that it went sailing into a window at General Pinch's house. And it hit him right in the belly. Poof. "That's it," he said. "I'm calling in the army." He runs to the window. He says, "I'm calling in the army." Now, the kids were scared because they didn't know what this meant. And everybody went to their house, and he picked up the phone, and the general said, "Army, come tomorrow at dawn. I want you to take out the house that looks not like any other house on the street and move it away from here." "Okay." He hung up the phone. That night, nobody could sleep. Everybody was so afraid for the Arabulis because he was going to take away their house. And Sally, who was kind of like head of the kids, well, she had an idea. So what she did was she got up in the middle of the night and she knocked on all her friends' doors and she said, "Come on, we got to do something." And they went down to the basement of every one of their houses and they got all the kinds of paints they had, like blue and purple and yellow and neon green. And then they took the Christmas lights out. And they went from house to house and they painted all the houses, all these wacky colors, and put up the Christmas lights and the Halloween decorations on every house except General Pinch's and Mrs. Pinch's house. That house stayed white, just like all the others were before. And they went to bed satisfied. And the next morning you could hear the rumble of the tanks and the marching of the soldiers. You know, and armies aren't too smart. They just follow orders. No offense to our military personnel. And they're driving in, and they're like, well, they're looking. All the houses are really different. Only one looks really different is the one that's painted just white. So they go, "This must be it." And they go, and they jack it up. And General Pinch goes, "What are you doing, you idiots? No." And they put the house on a big truck, and they take it out into a field, and they drop it down in the field, and Mrs. Pinch and General Pinch live there still, and the Arabulis and the rest of the people on Liberty Street are very happy being very different. And that's our story. We're going to sing the kids out. My reading today comes from Paul Raiser, who is a theologian and philosopher, a Unitarian Universalist, at the forefront of some of our most innovative thinking about how we might reclaim our place in the public square as Unitarian Universalists. He writes, "The tension between democracy and empire seems to be a permanent feature of the American condition. By the same token, religious liberals seem cursed to live with a tension between energizing hope and the temptation towards paralyzing cynicism. But we must recognize that cynicism is a luxury of privilege, a negative spirituality that in the end only feeds the forces of empire. We can maintain our hope and be true to our own religious ideals if we remember that this very dissonance, this tension that so often frustrates us, can be creative as well as destructive. It can fuel the passion to question, the courage to be prophetic, and the faith to have hope."
There's two glasses of water up here. My wife must think this is a long sermon. Thank you, darling. One will do it. What a week it has been, huh? Pretty incredible. I've really enjoyed this week. Everyone kept asking me, am I exhausted? Which is a fair question to ask an introvert. Am I exhausted? I actually find myself more energized than I think I have been in a very long time in my life. This ministry feels good and compelling. It feels right. It feels like now is the time. As many of you know, I like to share a few stories as I go along in my preaching career, and this one actually happened about a year ago with our church in New Orleans, the First Unitarian Church of New Orleans. And they were having a worship service, as they would at the time of day that is put aside for worship. And they were in their most sacred time of prayer and meditation. And visitors had come that Sunday, that special Sunday. It was a summer Sunday, and they had come in wearing jackets and buttoned-up shirts. Of course, that's a little strange for a Unitarian Universalist congregation. Today's an exception, of course. And suddenly, in the middle of this time of meditation and prayer, they tore off their jackets and opened up their shirts, and they were wearing T-shirts that said Operation Save America, which is an abortion fundamentalist group that seeks to disrupt abortion clinics and churches that actually support the right to choose. Out of the sacred silence, they began yelling about how our church, our First Unitarian Church of New Orleans, was a place of Satan, a church of murderers. For you see, just a few weeks before, the only Planned Parenthood clinic in all of New Orleans had used the church for its groundbreaking ceremony since their building two blocks away, since their building site was flooded by rain. The Reverend Deanna Vandiver, the church's community minister who was leading worship that day, told Rachel Maddow the most amazing thing had happened at that moment. In the midst of this incredible violation, can you imagine it here? In the midst of that incredible violation, the youth group, who had just spent the week being trained in leadership, made a circle around the congregation and kept the protesters on the outside of the circle, and they started singing Spirit of Life. And over their voices, Reverend Deanna asked the protesters to either join in singing or to take their protest across the threshold of the church and go outside. Well, they did just that. They went outside and they took their signs and their anger, and they went over to the religious education building and pushed their signs up against the glass so the kids could see it. And again, our young adults who were caring for those young ones that Sunday acted quickly, and they simply picked up the children and they took them to an interior room. Operation Save America decried the invasion publicly, but on its website congratulated the protesters for their, quote, dynamic witness. In the interview with Rachel Maddow, Reverend Deanna said she was grateful that her people were not willing to live in fear, but were willing to stand on the side of love. They acted from a place of compassion and respect, even though that was not what they were feeling at that time. And she went on to say that regardless of anyone's belief about abortion, to invade a church service was denying the fundamental right of our democracy, the right to peacefully practice our religion. our religion, as Ed Thompson just composed the Theodore Parker piece, is like sunshine and goes everywhere. So today I'm going to speak to you about how we might enlarge our civic circumference with the fire of our faith. Not the rights or failures of the American culture or the heart-wrenching challenge of choosing an abortion. Instead, I want to talk about courage, the courage to save lives. Listen again to what Reverend Deanna said. When she spoke so calmly, she was grateful for her people who were not going to give in to fear. Despite what they were feeling, they acted out of compassion and respect. In my 25 years in ministry, I think I've come to believe fairly strongly that in order to live the full spiritual life, in order to live the grace-filled life that I talked about last Sunday, we must act in a way that goes beyond our individual feelings. You know, we pride ourselves, don't we, on this individuality of belief. So often, when someone asks you what Unitarian Universalists believe, you say what? You say, well, I know kids say this because I've heard them say it. They say, oh, you can believe in whatever you want. And I have to tell you, as a minister, I cringe when I hear that because it's not quite that free. It's somewhere in between. So how many Unitarian Universalists does it take to change a light bulb? Well, we choose not to make a statement, either in favor or against the need of a light bulb. However, if in your journey you have found that the light bulb works for you, you're invited to write a poem or compose an interpretive dance about your personal experience with that light bulb. You may then present it next month at our annual light bulb service, where we will explore various light bulb traditions, including incandescent, fluorescent, three-way, and tinted light bulbs, all of which are equal paths to luminescence. I mean, seriously, folks, if we're going to change the world, we have to move beyond worrying about the light bulb and worrying about the light, and that takes courage. I don't think that courage in and of itself is so hard. I think working against fear is a lot harder, because fear is really the great Satan. Fear drives people to kill. Fear drives them to abandon their families, their principles, their communities, even this one. Courage rests in moving beyond fear and feelings towards that guiding principle of our free religion, compassion, trust, hope, and respect. Courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is reason over fear. That's what we see happening so often in our churches today. That's what we saw happen at the First Unitarian Church of New Orleans. The youth took seriously what we teach them, and that should be something that we keep in mind, because kids pay incredible attention to what we say and do. Take it from someone who has six kids and has been a preacher his whole life, and I can tell you that if I did one thing that was just a little off color, I had the moral police right at my elbow telling me what was right and what was wrong. By calming our fears of what will happen to us and trusting a little more in the goodwill of people, we are able to open ourselves up to a new kind of spirituality. It's not just that we're like-minded, it's that we're liberal in the midst of a less than progressive era. I think that there's also some fairly outstanding evidence that suggests that if we act courageously, if we act virtuously and kindly, we actually can train our brains to look at the world a different way. What Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, who is a professor at UCLA, calls the courage muscle. We could all use a little more courage muscle. I know I could. Many of us have been following the tragedy and riots in Baltimore this past week. And it might be easy for us to dismiss the riots or violence as a lack of law and order, or even to admit that it's fueled by our inherent racism, so far removed from our world here in Westport. But dismissals are a way of fear, not courage. Baltimore, my friends, is everywhere in America. It is everywhere. And we have a part to play in facing up to racism, a part to play that is in all of us. My colleague, the Reverend David Carl Olson, who is the minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Church in Baltimore. I might add, the church where William Ellery Channing first preached his landmark sermon, Unitarian Christianity, that began our religious movement, where David Carl Olson, after the riots in Baltimore, wrote this to his colleagues and friends. He said, after the war on drugs, after so-called zero tolerance policies by police that have, as he points out, criminalized childhood in Baltimore, this city has come to snatch up its streets again. And he reported that men and women and children, black and white, robed Catholic priests, Baptists, Methodists, Unitarian Universalists, gays marching along with the high school pom-pom squad, shaking their own pom-poms in skin-tight neon green suits while people were cheering them on. This is also Baltimore, he said. This is what courage can do when it overcomes fear. You know, I'm not a recovering alcoholic, and that sometimes is a mistake because I don't drink as much as I used to. There's a lot of reasons for that, but it's okay. I love some of the sayings that come out of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think is probably the most effective church in America, if I can be quite honest about it. And one of those sayings is that you have to fake it to make it. Fake it to make it. I'm sure that the Unitarian Universalists in New Orleans or in Baltimore really wish that this wasn't happening to them at that particular moment. They would just as soon have stayed home in bed. But being a liberal religion isn't easy, and it's certainly not timely. I have been to many, many protests in my life, many organized by communities of color, and I can remember trying to get my own people excited about going, and they say, well, if I could have had another week's notice, I mean, I can't quite get it into my calendar yet. And justice isn't about being timely. We often get lost also in arguments about what we do or don't do or fail to do, and we get lost in words and semantics. Robert Frost, a great poet and also a great Unitarian, once said that liberals are often so broad-minded that they forget to stand up for their own side. I've seen it happen. They start arguing with themselves. But we can do so much better than that. We here can move beyond our fear of change into a trust and love that is far beyond just the spiritual center of this beautiful church, out into the civic communities of which we're part. And don't be locked in by geography here. That's not what I'm talking about. We're part of communities that reach far beyond Westport, far out into the world. Unitarian Universalist communities, Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, Allies for Color, which is a new organization that we have helped found. All the different organizations that are beginning to emerge in a progressive era that is just waiting to be reborn, and we here are the vanguard of that. We can move beyond our fear of change, whether it's our fear of change in the community itself or the fear of change in the world in which we live, and we can light a spark, and we can make something new. In his book, A People So Bold, my good friend and colleague John Millspaugh reminds us that it's not just the principles we live by, but how we act on those principles, which is why they can never be fully achieved. Some people will hold up the principles of the Unitarian Universalist Association, those beautiful seven principles, and will say, well, we're not doing a very good job living up to this, are we? But you're never going to achieve the principle. It's a guiding light. It's a flame that burns, that has dimension. We have to begin first with interior courage, the swallowing of our own fear and going on with what might not go away so easily. Many years ago, I stood before a group of angry citizens in my role as the chair of the Human Relations Commission in Frederick, Maryland, which is a little town just outside of Washington, D.C., very conservative community. And I was there to introduce local legislation to county commissioners that would protect the rights of the LGBT community to have housing afforded to them. And we had actually done a study, an underground study, where we had sent folks in who were obviously very gay, and they tried to rent an apartment, and they were turned away. And so we put this legislation together. And I can tell you, standing before a couple of hundred unfriendly people is not like standing in front of your smiling faces. I can tell you the last thing I wanted to do was take comment from that group. Run for the hills was more like it. But I stayed. I stayed because my spiritual center was pushing at my civic circumference. I stayed because I thought of people like Theodore Parker, who in his work to help runaway slaves find their way out of slavery kept a loaded pistol on his desk. I stay because of the heritage of Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Susan B. Anthony or any of the suffragettes who worked towards change when a male world would have it any other way. I'm sure Reverend Deanna and Reverend Olson would have just assumed not deal with the haters. I'm sure that they would have not wanted to even be there, but they were. And while I'm at it, I'm sure that your beloved trustees, well, I can just go ahead and say this because I'm here, that your beloved trustees are working mightily to keep your church alive and functioning and well. And I can bet some days they would just assume not go to that meeting. Thank you very much. But they're here too, as you are today, for courage, because courage is what makes us liberal, really. Our spiritual formation, our liberal religion, calls on us to proclaim our principles over fear in the light of faith, to represent, as our chalice does, that very embodiment of our principles, this fire that burns at the center of who we are. Now, we like to make fun of ourselves. We like to have a little laugh here and there. We like to think we're really quite special, don't we? We do. We think we're different. Everyone, by the way, they've done studies on this, that most people think they're above average. I think I'm an above average preacher. But so do at least two-thirds of my colleagues. And I noticed here one of the things that I've been studying your liturgy, which is the way you do your order of service, and have been intrigued at where you do announcements. This is the bane of existence for many churches. Many congregations don't know what to do with announcements. In the congregation in California that I serve right now, we do announcements at the beginning. Well, I need to start the church a half an hour early because the announcements just go on and on and on and on. And I looked up a little guide to what different religions say about announcements because I thought it might be instructive for us. The Buddhists say that all announcements are suffering. And Muslims say that announcements are submission. And Christians say in heaven there are no announcements. And the Jews say, well, only your mother should be giving announcements. And of course the Unitarian Universalists say that in the interdependent web of all announcements, each one has its own worth and dignity. We do think we're different, don't we? But we're not. We're not that different. We're not that different than the 1,100 congregations in North America of which we're a part. We're not that different than most liberal religious people. We're not that different than most people who just seek meaning and solace and courage to face the day. And now I'm asking you, as your potential new senior minister, to go and expand that some more. Because I think in the expansion we become more. And we're not alone in our faith. We're not. We're part of a movement. That's why we call it, Unitarian Universalism is called a movement. It's not really a denomination, actually, technically. It's not. You're a freestanding congregation. You're about to exercise that authority of democracy, which is only yours to exercise. Only you can call a minister. Only you. No one else. Not from on high, not some bishop somewhere. Although I can tell you sometimes us ministers would like to have a bishop somewhere. But that's the way she rolls. And you are part of this great buzzing confusion that makes up who we are as Unitarian Universalists. And you need to remember that even in this sacred congregation, this beautiful community, with all this potential, this rocket on the firing pad that the engines have started, you are not alone. And you will orbit with other Unitarian Universalists. When I was standing at that podium in Frederick, Maryland, and facing that hostile crowd, I wasn't alone. I was standing with an entire tradition at my back. And about a third of my congregation was in the crowd, too, which helped a lot. I may call on you to do that from time to time. I may ask you to actually come and go to something with me. It's tempting in the midst of change and the insanity of the world in which we live in, the crisis in Baltimore, the crisis in Gaza, children dying as they're crossing the desert trying to come to America, to think that evil might have conquered us somehow. But I want you to take courage, my friends. I do. I want you to take courage because the world, while it suffers, is also immensely blessed. We are a free faith, and that freedom allows us to look at things differently than perhaps some of our other interfaith brothers and sisters. And we are called beyond fear into courage, to sing out the hatred, to gather up the children. We have two impulses that make up our reason for being a liberal religion, especially because we depend on one another to help discern meaning. Creating meaning is not something we do by ourselves. It's something we do together. Last week, in the first Sunday I was with you, I spoke about the need for every one of us to find a spiritual center in our lives that will hold us in the midst of difficulty and change, in spite of time and death and the space between the stars. And that interior journey that we crave needs an outer circumference in which to live, which is why we extend the light beyond these beautiful walls. Otherwise, we run the risk of being a church that only serves itself. The other day, as I was listening to the birds that I hadn't heard since my childhood, I heard geese. Now, I know what geese are about. I'm not naive. I know it's big poop and they bite and they're not very friendly. But I have lived almost my entire ministry by what is known as the three laws of the geese. Here are these Canadian geese, these really nasty birds, making the perilous journey from south to north and back again, every year, back and forth, thousands of miles, with nothing more than instinct. How do they survive and manage to keep going? Well, the first law of the geese is that they care for the fallen. If a goose falls, the entire flock goes down to help the one who has fallen. That's what it means to be part of a Unitarian Universalist congregation. And I said sometime during this week, I said, you know, it just may not be about you. It might be about us. And that's a different way of looking at things. Secondly, geese take turns being the leader. There's not always somebody, the same goose is in the front. They switch around a little bit. We call those elections. Shared leadership is the sign of a liberal and progressive faith, and it's a sign of courage. I don't need to tell the trustees in the room here that it takes courage to be a trustee. You have to stand up in front of people. They're not always nice. We need to be nice. But we also need to have the courage to lead. Because if you don't lead, the people have no one to follow. And finally, the third law of the geese is that you honk encouragement from behind. And that's your job. Whatever we do in the world together, those of you who aren't quite at the front lines need to honk encouragement from behind, because this is what it's going to take to make a free faith here in Westport and beyond. None of us are courageous alone. All of us need one another, whether it's a church in New Orleans, the front lines in Afghanistan, in Baltimore, here in Westport, providing water for children who are crossing the desert, as the church in Tucson, Arizona is doing. We are courageous simply by coming together and being here. And we can invite our friends to church, which is also an act of courage, I understand. So this is good. You know, our forebears were burned at the stake for what they believed. Michael Servetus was burned in 1553 for proposing that Jesus was a man who gave his life for a saving message, and we would do well to follow him. John Huss, a forebearer in our Universalist heritage, was burned at the stake for the audacity to propose that we're all the same in the eyes of God. That's where that chalice comes from. He offered the chalice, which was just for the priests, to all the people of the church. And for that, he was burned at the stake. The Reverend James Reeb, who was martyred 50 years ago during a march on Selma by white thugs, standing with his African-American sisters and brothers in the cause of justice. Viola Luzzo, One of our more active lay people from Detroit was shot by the KKK as she drove to Montgomery to pick up weary marchers. Our people have actually died to bring this message to us. And the Reverend Jason Sheldon, whose song Fire of Commitment we're going to sing in a moment, said once to me, "What would we be persecuted for today? What would we surrender our lives for today? What can we save, and who can we save with our courage?" I believe that we are here literally to save lives. I don't think that's hyperbole. It might even be your own. We need the light and the heat of our faith to carry us forward. A few years ago, a middle-aged man started coming to my congregation in California. He was an aide to one of our elders. His name was Roland. He was Haitian. And I noticed that he was impeccably dressed. And when I would speak to him, his diction was perfect, clearly, though English was not his first language. He would listen to the sermons. He would sing. He was a wonderful baritone. And after some time, he asked me for an appointment. He'd been coming about 3 or 4 months along with the person he was taking care of. And he came to me, and I said, "Well, let's sit down in my office and let's talk." And we sat down together, and he said he was going to be leaving his work as an aide, and he was going to go to law school. Well, I realized, and this is a horror to many ministers, I realized that he knew absolutely nothing about this guy. And then I began to wonder, well, was it because he was a person of color? And I, you know, all the things that we good, you know, conscious Unitarians feel guilty about. And I'm sitting there and I'm listening to him, and I said, "Tell me your story. I don't know your story," which, by the way, I'm not going to make that mistake with you. We're going to find a way to get to see most of your stories. And he sat down across me and I said, "Tell me about your life." And he said, "Well, actually, he'd gone to MIT. He'd gone to Boston College and then he went to MIT. He had a graduate degree in electronic engineering." I went, "Whoa, back up. Where did this all start?" And he said, "Listen, what I need you to know first, Reverend, is that this church saved my life. I grew up in Haiti. My father was a colonel in Papa Doc's army. One night, a band of armed men came to our house. They dragged my father out of the house and they shot him. Then they dragged my older brother out of the house and they shot him. My mother and I managed to escape. We traveled day and night to the Dominican Republic, and from there we were able to go to the United States and seek political asylum. I worked hard. I supported my mother. I went to school. I did well." He said, "After I graduated from MIT, I went to Southern California to work in aerospace. I worked on the Hubble telescope. I married the woman of my dreams. Unfortunately, she died 6 months later of cancer. And then I decided that all this pressure was not what I needed. I needed something else, so I left electrical engineering to take care of elders. I thought, this is what I want to do, and the man I had been caring for would be the age of my father." But he said, "Reverend, for many years I've had these nightmares, terrifying nightmares about my father and my brother's murders. I went to see doctors. I took drugs. I changed careers. I came close to suicide. But since coming here and learning that we have the power of God within us, the nightmares have stopped. They've stopped. So I decided that because they stopped, this was a sign that I should move on. And so I'm going to become a lawyer to defend the rights of the politically persecuted. I need to go on. But I want you to know that you Unitarians saved my life. Don't stop." My friends, we don't get to see how this faith in the power of each other changes lives very often, but they do. And I would ask us today to consider how we will burn for change, because I believe we are tender for the world. Anybody got a match? Amen. My benediction comes from Gene Olson. "May you be brave enough to expose your aching woundedness and reveal your vulnerability. May you speak your deepest truths, knowing that they will change as you do.
May you sing the music within you, composing your own melody, playing your own song with all your heart. May you draw and paint and sculpt and sew, showing the world something of your vision. May you write letters, poetry, biography, slogans, graffiti, that great novel, laying bare your words to love. May you love even though your heart breaks again and again. And until the end of your days, may your life be filled with possibilities and courage. From here we go in peace. And now the service truly begins.